May it please the Court, Davina Chen for James Wilkinson. I would like to try to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case raises two issues, a search issue and a sentencing issue. I'd like to start briefly with the search issue because I think it's very strong and I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle of the big ACCA issue.
Okay.
The search in this case was legal only if the officers had probable cause to believe on December 1st that Mr. Wilkinson was living in his girlfriend's apartment. They did not. This case really rises and falls on the government's claim that his girlfriend's statement 2 months previously gave the officers probable cause. It did not.
Well, she told him 2 months before that they were together, but then didn't he also have a key to the apartment?
He did not have a key to the apartment. She told them 2 months previous that they were together, but that they would be moving out in 2 days. So it was a requirement for the officers to confirm that he was actually and still living there on December 1st before the search could fall within the DOC compliance search conditions.
The district court, as I recall, held that it credited the girlfriend's testimony, correct?
Actually, the district court credited the officer's
the officer's testimony about what they understood. So would we need to determine that that was a clear error finding in order to hold for you?
No, because what the officer said that she said 2 months earlier was that they were living together, but they would be moving out in 2 days. The search did not occur until 2 months later. So it was incumbent upon the officers to confirm that he was actually and still living there. And they tried to. They did not just go and search the apartment. They tried to. They asked a task force officer who worked in that area to drive by the apartment regularly to look to see if cars that they thought were Mr. Wilkinson's were there. And over a 2 month period, cars that they thought were his were seen at the apartment a total of 3 times. 3 times in 2 months. That is not living somewhere. And when they went to surveil the apartment on those 3 occasions where a car that was reportedly Mr. Wilkinson's, they never confirmed it was his. They never saw Mr. Wilkinson. So let's be clear. This is a search of an apartment based on the allegation that it was Mr. Wilkinson's residence when no officer ever saw him there. Now, they did attempt to confirm with the apartment manager that he lived there, but she didn't say so either. So this is in sharp contrast to Mr. Wilkinson's supervising officer, Mr. Pica, who regularly and repeatedly had contact with Mr. Wilkinson and never once suspected that he was not living as reported in Auburn. He met with him every month. He spoke to him frequently about his domestic violence and drug treatment programs. He visited that motel numerous times. The motel manager repeatedly told him, yes, he's living here. In fact, twice after the girlfriend allegedly said that Mr. Wilkinson was living in Tacoma, twice when CCO Pica went to the motel manager said, oh, yeah, I saw him here today. And as recently as 2 days before the search in Tacoma, the motel manager said, yes, he's still staying here. So this case is in sharp contrast to the cases that the government relies on. They rely most heavily on a case called
Watts. Is it your position that he can only have one residence?
No.
I mean, the testimony could support the fact that he was actually living in two places and spending half his time there and half his time in the other place.
Sure, but the evidence is no stronger that the Tacoma apartment is one of his two residences than it was his only residence.
Well, I mean, the evidence that you've recounted, there is some evidence to support the belief, including, I guess, most strongly, the fiancé's statement that they were living together.
That they were living together and that they were moving out in 2 days.
Well, true, but if they're still seeing his car at the complex more than 2 days later, couldn't they also conclude that they hadn't yet moved out?
First of all, they never confirmed it was his car. The apartment manager...
How did they know the cars were associated with him?
They say that they had a confidential informant who reported those cars being associated with him, and this confidential informant said that it was a white F-150 pickup, whereas the apartment manager said, fancy cars. I'm not sure what fancy is.
But did the officers then go to the apartment complex and find a white Ford F-150 pickup?
3 times in 2 months.
Well, but why doesn't that corroborate the information that the informant gave to the police?
In Granbury, the officers saw the individual enter an apartment by himself with a key 6 to 10 times in 11 periods.
You're not answering my question.
It corroborates that perhaps Mr. Wilkinson was visiting Ms. S.C.
Well,
but
he was still living with her at that location.
3 times in 2 months?
Well, I mean, why else would the car be there?
Because he was visiting her. This court has been very clear.
She said they were living together. So how did we get from living together to just visiting?
She said that they were living together 2 months earlier and that they were moving out in 2 days.
But apparently they hadn't because his car was still there.
His car was there 3 times in 2 months, Your Honor. This court is very clear
where we differ is whether or not the surveillance coupled with the information that they had from the informant and from the fiancé is sufficient to give the officers probable cause to believe that he was living at that location.
That is exactly what we're talking about.
Okay.
And I would argue that the surveillance actually contradicts that.
Well, to go back to Judge McEwen's question, if these are sort of intensely fact-bound determinations, don't we have to declare that the district court was clearly erroneous when it concluded, based on this evidence, that they had corroborated that he was still there?
This court reviews probable cause de novo. So the factual findings...
Well, it's a mixed question of law and fact, is it not?
Yes, reviewed de novo. This court has never held that...
Counsel, it's a two-step process. First, we have to determine whether or not there was clear error in the underlying factual findings, and this is an intensely fact-driven determination. Then we apply the law de novo to determine whether, as a matter of law, those facts, if credited, would establish probable cause. Isn't that the test?
I agree that that's the test, okay. And I would argue that even if you accept every single fact that the government alleges, every single one of them, that Ms. SC said this 2 months previously, that they saw his car 3 times in 2 months, that there was constant contact at the Auburn Motel, even if you accept every single fact that the government alleges, it's still not probable cause under a de novo review.
I do want to turn to my other issue
because it looks like I'm already at... Turning to the sentencing issue, this court doesn't even need to reach the question of whether the offense was violent because it was not punishable by more than 1 year.
Well, how do you interpret Washington State's sentencing statute? The statute is punishable by 10 years or 20 years imprisonment, is it not?
By 10 years, absolutely. But under Caraccioli, Rosendo, and Moncrief, we have to look at what facts were established by the record of conviction.
Well, let's first deal with the law. There's another statute that then establishes a standard sentencing range, but the law also provides that the superior court judge can impose an extraordinary sentence above or below that range if the court articulates reasons to do so. Isn't that what the law says?
Correct. And the
court did not. So why is that statute not punishable by imprisonment for more than a year?
The statute is punishable by imprisonment by more than 10 years. This crime, as punished in this case, was not punishable by more than 1 year.
Doesn't that do exactly what the Supreme Court told us not to do in DeCamps? I thought this is a categorical analysis, not a fact-driven analysis.
It does exactly what the Supreme Court said to do in DeCamps, which is to look at what was established by the record of conviction. And in this case, the record of conviction establishes Washington residential burglary is a level 4 offense. Mr. Wilkinson was criminal history category 1. He had no priors. The sentencing range was 6 to 12 months, and the judge found no exceptional circumstances.
But the statute... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Where I get stuck is that it seems to me that that's exactly what we're not supposed to be doing, which is we're looking at a case-by-case basis as, you know, and even in the federal sentencing guidelines, there's a possibility for downward departures and all kinds of things that could have happened. But we're looking at... by what is the crime punishable by? And that's where it seems to me, and I appreciate your comments, that you cite some cases from, I think it's Kansas and North Carolina, but those systems were different. And here, this crime is punishable by the fixed amount that Judge Tolman talked about. So I'm still having trouble fitting your argument into DeCamp and the fact that it's different from those cases.
I don't think it is different from North Carolina and Kansas. I looked carefully last night at North Carolina and Kansas's sentencing structures. Each one of them has a standard range. So in North Carolina, they have a mitigated range, a standard range, and an aggravated range. In order to get sentenced in the aggravated range, the judge needs to make an extra finding. And so several courts, the Fourth, and now it looks like the Fifth, also, and the Solicitor General has conceded that under the North Carolina statute, the maximum for the purposes of this analysis is the top of the standard range. So that somebody could be punished by more than a year, just not the defendant in that case. Similarly, in Kansas, it's the same sort of system. There's a standard range, and if the judge finds facts to go above the standard range, they can go up to twice the standard range. They have this rule called the double rule, and then they have the double-double rule. But we're just talking about the double rule. So if a judge makes a finding that an aggravated sentence is warranted, the court can go above.
Up to 20 years. Here.
Oh, up to in that.
No. In Washington, if the court decides to impose an extraordinary sentence, it can impose that sentence up to 20 years.
Up to 10 years in this case, that's correct. But the judge did not make that finding. And what Moncrief and Carachuri Rosendo tell us is we're not supposed to hypothesize. Perhaps if the judge had made a finding, he could have been sentenced up to 10 years. We're supposed to look at the actual prosecution of the actual case.
But there's no finding required in Washington. All the statute says is that if the court imposes that extraordinary sentence, it must simply tell the Court of Appeals why.
There is a finding required. Washington law is very clear that they must find something that is not an element of the offense. In State versus Gore, the Washington Supreme Court was very clear. You cannot impose an aggravating sentence based on an element of the offense or something that went into the standard range. So in order to get an aggravated sentence, the court must make a finding. That's what Blakely was about. Now, I'm not saying this is a Blakely case, but Blakely interpreted the law of Washington.
Okay, well, you're running out of time. Let me ask one last question. The time issue is a tricky one. But if you have a statute that's overbroad and is not divisible, if we agreed with you on that point, this whole 1 year wouldn't matter, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't we hear from the government?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Helen Bruner. I'm here to represent the United States. Let me start very briefly with the suppression question, and because I think it's important to address a couple of factual issues that I think are clear from the record and were not clear as a result of the discussion here this morning. First of all, we did have the probable cause is based on the statement of SC to the officers on September 28th, but that probable cause is also corroborated. It's corroborated by the fact that the manager very clearly says to the officers that she still lives there when they investigate in November of 2011, and that Mr. Wilkinson had paid rent in cash on several occasions when she was late in the rent. It also is clear from the record that the officers started their surveillance of the Brookside apartments, which was searched in November of 2011. So it was 1 month. And on three occasions, they saw cars that the truck and the SUV that the informant said was associated with Mr. Wilkinson in the parking lot. They did run the plates. The plates come back to Enterprise Rental Car, and we know, and they knew from the informant that he was renting cars from Enterprise Rental Car. And with respect to Mr. Pica's observations, what the court had in front of it was not the testimony of Mr. Pica, but rather his chrono notes. And so some of this is supposition of what he might believe to be true. There's no doubt that Mr. Wilkinson was paying for rent at the motel in Auburn, but it's also equally conceivable that the manager saw him there when he came to pay rent or came to establish that he might still have a residence there so that he could show his probation officer he was complying with the obligation to remain, to live in the state in King County and remain in King County. So I think the facts in this case, based primarily on her SC statements and then the corroborating evidence, is more than enough to establish probable cause that he was living and staying at that residence in Brookside.
From Auburn to Tacoma would have also been in violation of his probation condition.
Exactly. The condition.
Tacoma's in Pierce County and Auburn is in King for my colleague from San Diego.
Exactly.
Thank you, Judge Tallman.
You're welcome.
And I apologize for not pointing that out. So with respect to the second issue,
Could I ask you on the second issue? It's very logical to start with the 1 year. Could you start with the second part of it, and that's whether this is a divisible statute and whether it's overbroad?
Your Honor, I do think it's a divisible statute, and let me start then there under DeCamps. And I have said to several people, I think this is the issue of divisibility is becoming more complex, and it makes my head hurt when I think about it. But I think this actually does satisfy it for a couple of different reasons, and I think the arguments sort of break down into two places. With respect to the fact that this is a statute that, like the generic burglary set out in Taylor, makes it a crime to illegally or unlawfully enter a residence and unlawfully remain in a residence. Yes, the Washington courts, as cited by counsel in particular State versus Collins, does talk about whether or not there needs to be a unanimity instruction, but when you look at Collins, I'm mixing up my two state cases, but in any event, what the state courts have said is if there's insufficient evidence as to the two alternative means, then there needs to be a unanimity instruction. And when the cases of the state court that are cited in the briefing also make clear is that where someone has unlawfully entered and then remains within to commit the crime, they've also unlawfully remained. So as a practical matter, those two things often go hand in hand, and which is why the state courts have not required the unanimity instruction unless the government has charged it in that way and cannot prove both things.
Well, let me turn to a recent case of Rendon.
Yes.
And in your brief, as I read it, you were characterizing this unlawful entry and unlawful remaining as means as opposed to elements. And now we have Rendon, which basically says that it's black letter law that a statute is divisible only if it contains alternative elements. So how do you square the statement in your brief with what Rendon now tells us is absolutely clear?
I think I would respond to that, Your Honor, by saying that means and pointing to the language actually in DeCamps, where Justice Kagan talks about means and elements and whether means and elements have some interchangeability. I think here, whether you label it as means or elements, you have to prove to establish burglary of a residence or residential burglary under Washington law that someone either entered illegally or remained illegally. And as I explained, in many cases, it's both because they break, they enter, they remain and then they commit the crime they're in.
When I was in law school, I represented these people who went to the White House on a tour and then they didn't leave. And they were charged with unlawful entry, of course. So that's kind of this kind of statute that we have here. And I haven't quite heard an answer as to why in your brief it's characterized as one thing and Rendon actually makes clear there is a difference between elements and means. So why isn't the means by which you can have unlawful entry alternative means but not elements?
Well, if
I mean, the courts have put, the Supreme Court has put us in this with Decamp and all of its cousins. So we are splitting hairs, I realize, but there are hairs that need to be split.
I agree, Your Honor. I think perhaps we used a term. Let me perhaps answer the question this way. When you're saying alternative elements, and if I understand correctly, where Rendon is taking us, it's effectively saying if you have two separate crimes charged in the statute, if you can show that these are alternative elements of the same crime, not that you'd need both of those elements.
Well, to take Judge McEwen's clinic case, wouldn't the jury in Washington State have to be instructed that it would have to determine by unanimous vote whether it was either an illegal entry or an illegal remaining in the White House in order to convict for burglary under the Washington statute?
As I understand Washington law from having attempted to parse through the cases.
We've been doing the same thing and struggling with the same question.
I think part of the problem is that most of the cases, there is no question that both things come together, which is why I think the case is.
Well, that's why I gave you my case.
Yeah.
Because, but, you can go into, there's a lot of situations where you could go in legally and you could extend where you are in a place, or you could be invited in but then asked to leave a shopping center. So I don't think it's a hypothetical in real life.
I don't mean that that it would be. I think what I'm attempting to say here is that when the courts in Washington State are talking about when you need a unanimity instruction, they were clear that if the evidence was sufficient to prove both an unlawful entry and an unlawful remaining, that no unanimity instruction was necessary.
I mean, it's a no-brainer if the guy breaks his way into a residence at night and then remains within to steal things. It's a harder question with regard to, did he enter on a tour of the White House and then decide to stay after the tour guide took the rest of the people out and they closed the White House for the day? And as I understand Washington law, in that instance, you would need to instruct the jury on unanimity with respect to what his intent was at the entrance versus what he had in mind when he remained.
Exactly. And I think Collins also makes that clear, that if someone enters lawfully but then stays beyond the point at which the invitation to come in permitted. So, for example, in Collins, the invitation to come in to use the telephone and then remaining therein was in violation of the statute and would have required what was considered unlawfully remaining.
Now, counsel, we are running out of time, but I did want to get back to the one-year question.
Yes.
Is it your position that the various cases that Ms. Chan has cited from the Fourth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, that those cases are legally correct, but that the Washington law is just different than those states? Or is it your position that those cases are wrong because of the dissents, for example, in those cases?
Well, the government's position is that Washington's statute is just different. In Simmons, the North Carolina statute makes clear that the judges did not have discretion to go above 1 year. under those circumstances, once you did the calculation, once you looked at the criminal history and the other factors in the statute, you could not exceed if the calculation then resulted in 1 year, you could not exceed it. That's what the fundamental difference here is. Washington law allows the court discretion, certainly at the time Mr. Wilkinson's conviction took place in 1994. We didn't have Blakely yet, so the question was not even whether or not there needed to be a jury finding in any way, shape, or form. The court simply had discretion, and the factors that are listed in the statute were not exclusive factors. So they're just simply not analogous statutes. And for that reason, I would suggest that Simmons and Brooks simply are not controlling here, that they're very different.
Final question on the topic from me. Because the district court never analyzed the one-year question under the cases we've just been discussing, what would the harm be for us to remand this question, if we need to reach the one-year question, to the district court to consider anew what Washington law is, why is it the same or different than North Carolina? Because I don't think there hasn't been a lot of briefing at all on this question.
No, it was not raised in the district court. Your Honor, I think this court could decide it if it wanted. It could also, I suppose, remand it to the district court on an open record and allow us to relitigate all of this. I think the choices that the court has, I do think it is a legal issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, 1 second on the one-year issue. The government cited HARP in its brief, implicitly acknowledging that the North Carolina statute and the Washington statutes are analogous. They cited HARP as their authority. Let me move to the divisibility issue. I think after Rendon, the court has identified it's perfectly clear that juror unanimity is the requirement to determine whether a statute is divisible. And I think I heard the government counsel concede that jurors are not instructed in Washington State that they need to be unanimous as to unlawfully entered or unlawfully remained in.
No, I don't think you misunderstood. It depends on what the prosecution has charged in the information with respect to the facts supporting the burglary charge.
So in this case, they charged both unlawfully entering and remaining. And I don't think we can look at the facts. I think that is exactly where this court got off track on Aguila Montes de Oca, where they said, well, if you look at the facts and you can determine based on the theory of the prosecution's case that it really was one or the other,
so
then
we can look at the facts if it favors the defendant, but we can't look at the facts if we're trying to apply a categorical approach to the statute.
I don't believe we can look at the facts in the Rendon issue. I think that the Supreme Court and this court are very clear it's elements that matter, not facts. And I think that that's consistent both in the one-year rule and this rule. In either event, we have to look at what was actually convicted. In this case, the elements of the offense are overbroad. It's undisputed.
Okay, I think you're repeating yourself now, and we have your argument in mind. So I want to thank both counsel for both the briefing and the argument. It's a very interesting questions. The case of United States versus Wilkinson is submitted.